And now, with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved, here is Dr. James Houck.
Hey everybody, wherever you are in the world currently, welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, helping you find your courage to reclaim that which has always been in you. In fact, helping you reclaim that which you have always been, and you are. Very excited to be with you here today and every other Wednesday. I really enjoy being here. As you know, if you've been listening to me for some time, that each and every other week, should say that these broadcasts are dedicated to integrating spirituality and our mental health, all within the context of our relationships with ourselves, others, God, and or the divine. I am Dr. James Houck, and if you would like more information about me, or if you want to leave me your comments about this show, I invite you to visit that website. It is www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. That's all one word there. So www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. Or there's also an alternative website. It's www.reclaiming-authenticity.com. So either one, I will be able to see your comments about the show today. And just in case you cannot spend the entire hour with me, no worries, no worries at all, because this broadcast will be posted on the BBS Radio website, so you can go back and listen again or check the archives for previous shows. Now, these podcasts are also available for download on iTunes, Audible, Spotify, and Amazon Music. And I just want to say briefly that, people ask me all the time, like, what is this integration that you keep talking about regarding our spirituality and our mental health? You know, because everybody talks about integration, integration, integration. But this is a rather unique integration of our spirituality and our mental health. And I consider this to be very essential because quite often our minds interpret what we take in through our senses. And based on our previous experiences or education levels or upbringing and so forth, our mind's interpretation, let's just say, often fail to capture a more accurate understanding of deeper lessons or realities or greater truths, because our egos, they come right on the tail of the mind. Our egos are very self-centered and very limited. And it comes in, it wants to take over, and it wants to keep us from knowing ourselves as vast and eternal souls and living in just this attitude of forgiveness, gratitude, bliss, and love. So again, this is, you know, this integration of spirituality and our mental health is very essential, because I have never forgotten what was taught to me decades ago, that the more faithful, let's just say, the more faithful we are to an integration process, and in this case, the integration of our spirituality and our mental health, sooner or later, a wonderful transformation is going to occur. I can't tell you when, but the more faithful you are to this integration of your spirituality and your mental health, a transformation will occur, and you will be very, very pleased. However, it might require you to let go of things in which no longer serve you, which is not a bad thing. That's part of your growth. That's part of your understanding. That's part of you learning to see yourself as that soul that is limitless and vast. Okay. Well, just going back to the ego real quickly here, admittedly, it is our egos that lead us astray with all kinds of thoughts and selfish pursuits. And I often refer to it as like a lower level consciousness, if you were, which is always bound by a time, a space, and causation. And you know what I'm talking about when you've heard the expression of the monkey mind, just our minds are restless. It can never sit still. It's always jumping around, and our egos are right there to say, give me this, give me that. It vies for our attention and starts to woo us away with unhealthy thoughts or unhealthy words or unhealthy behaviors because the ego wants what it wants, what it wants. However, we can't let that happen. We have to be able to tame the ego, see it for what it is, and work beyond that. And so this integration of our spirituality and our mental health is a huge, huge factor in that. Okay. And furthermore about our egos here, just think about it this way. How often are we guilty of not paying attention to our egos and our mind's distorted templates, as it were, for teaching us something more about ourselves, as well as showing us where our healing and transformation are still needed? For example, if you're asking yourself right now, well, okay, that's good, but where do I even begin? Well, we begin by being brutally honest with ourselves, and we ask ourselves some very tough questions, such as, where am I struggling to forgive? Where am I holding grudges? Where have I allowed bitterness over time to creep in? Do I have a lack of gratitude? Do I come across kind of harsh with the people that I deal with day in and day out, even strangers? Do I often, or should say, am I told often that I just have this mean-spiritedness and just an overall hatred for others? And maybe even we struggle with a little bit of self-loathing. You see, these are all parts of the ego. Because the ego vies for, well, I don't need to forgive that person. I can just hold this grudge because, after all, it's not my fault. Or I don't need to be grateful. I mean, what do I have to be grateful for? Or just being mean-spirited is like, I don't got time for others. But you hear the tone? I mean, that's our mind coming in and based on our experiences and saying, you don't need to look at things a new way because we're going to keep you right there with that ugliness, let's just say. But let's move it into just a huge realm of love, okay? Just for the sake of argument here. Because there is a huge difference between worldly love, which is most familiar to us, and godly or divine love, okay? Now, according to my teacher and very dear friend, we often use this term, I love you. Or I love chocolate ice cream, or love gets batted around with everything. I love to have weekends off, all that stuff. But such love is conditional because it's temporary and it changes as it goes back and forth of conflicting emotions of the mind, such as envy or jealousy or hatred. But yet, on the other hand, godly or divine love is a love that's not entangled in the human emotions of the mind. Divine love is eternal. It's not conditional. And it helps us and others purify our minds by realizing our oneness in relation to one another, to all people and all things. So, whenever we wound somebody, we're in a sense wounding ourselves. And whenever we're holding grudges, in a sense, we're holding a grudge against ourselves. We have different names for this. It could be karma. It could be what goes around comes around. It could be, well, you reap what you sow. Every major religion out there has this aspect to its practices, observances, beliefs, rituals, and so forth. And it's all based in, they all are based in relationships. How do I reach out to this God, this divine being, and how do I live it out on a daily basis among my fellow human beings? Okay. And this is what reclaiming authenticity is all about. It can be summed up in just one word, namaste, which is roughly translated because I see myself as a soul of light, This allows me to greet your lighted soul of who you are, even if you don't see it in yourself yet. Now, again, this integration of spirituality and our mental health begins right here with namaste, because when we examine and implement a oneness integration, let's just say, we're going to come face to face with our deepest physical, emotional, psychological, and even spiritual wounds in our relationships. You know, but in addition, we may believe that we will find happiness and joy and contentment, only to discover that the larger our egos become, the greater the sorrows emerge. You see, eventually our ego brings us back to coming to terms with our relationship in our lives, especially our woundedness within families and coworkers, our friends, and other relationships. But godly or divine love heals and transforms these wounds into something more life-giving, tangible, and definitely eternal. And this transformation is especially needed with the people whom society still says are unlovable. And if they're unlovable, well, then they're just unreachable. And if they're unlovable and they're unreachable according to society, then they're off limits. They are untouchable. But when we do the work of integrating healthier ways of suppressing this ego by embracing our values of dignity and worth as souls, we transform ourselves. And through our presence and grace and understanding and so forth, we will transform others with forgiveness, gratitude, and love. Or, you know, I keep coming back to the a quote, just one of my favorite authors. He's a Dutch priest and a professor, Henry Nouwen. He puts it in one of his books, just by paying attention to what's going on around us, we discover that there are people who heal each other's wounds and forgive each other's offenses. They share their possessions and they foster this spirit of community. They celebrate the gifts that they have received and live in constant anticipation of the full manifestation of God's glory. I mean, that's a powerful quote. So don't get trapped in the illusion that you have to go in search of something that you already have. Discover who you are and be that soulful presence in the world, as well as be through your presence, the healing that people in this world are so desperately crying out for. Well, that was just a warm-up, folks, because today this particular message is a very somber one. It's something that's very near and dear to my heart. And the title of this show is That Non-Apologies Become the Salt in Tomorrow's Tears. And as I said, this is a special show that's very near and dear to my heart regarding historical trauma or intergenerational trauma, because I recently came across an article that was published on February the 26th, 2026, okay, just a couple of weeks ago. And it was from the BBC. And they reported that the Cork City Council in Ireland has provided conditional permission, as they put it, to developer Estuary View Enterprises for the 140 apartment units that they want to build, as well as other developments, at the site of the Bessborough Mother Baby Home in County Cork, Ireland. And these units, these 140 apartment units, they're going to extend over three blocks of ground. So this build, this development is quite substantial. And in another article, something very similar that the Irish Examiner ran, you know, it was their article was entitled, Bessborough Planning Decision is Shocking for Mother and Baby Home Survivors. Now, why is this important? Why do we need to pay attention to this? You know, because I mean, I mentioned these articles because next Wednesday, March 18th, the day after St. Patrick's Day, there's going to be an organized protest to stop the development of that particular site at 5:30 p.m. at the Dáil in Dublin, Ireland. You know, that's the seat of their government right there. And I'm not going to be able to go over there. I wish I could. I would love to be over there. But 5:30 their time, p.m. And it's interesting that the ex-residents and the campaigners have long objected to previous attempts to develop this site, fearing that it will definitely encroach on the burial sites yet to be found. Well, you might ask yourself, well, they can't do that because a cemetery is a cemetery. Well, very politely speaking, I didn't mention anything about a cemetery because reports of there have been 923 children who died at the mother-baby home in Bessborough, but only 64 have known graves. So where are the remaining? What happened to them? Nobody's talking. Well, I just want to give you a little bit more background as to why this decision to build on this site is alarming. The Bessborough Mother and Baby Home operated somewhere around 1922 until 1998. Okay? 1998. Yes. And it was one of a network of institutions that housed single mothers and babies during a time when most women were, again, for lack of a better word, ostracized for becoming pregnant outside of marriage. Now, according to these articles, many of the institutions had high infant mortality due to the harsh living conditions, which included overcrowding, malnutrition, and poor infection control. Now, you know, I'm not making this up. I mean, it is well documented. And a six-year state inquiry into the Irish mother and baby homes, they concluded, I don't know how much this cost, but after 6 years, I'm sure it was very costly. But this state inquiry, they concluded that a total of 923 children spent time in Bessborough. They died during its time in operation. And yet, despite the very extensive inquiries and searches, the Mother and Baby Homes Commission of Investigation was only able to establish the burial places of only 64 children. And those are their words. Okay. However, not all the grounds in Bessborough were excavated, let's just say. So by granting an independent developer to build on this site, the possibility of uncovering the truth, so to speak, of where the remaining 923 children who died there may be lost forever. Now, I became aware of other crimes against humanity throughout the world in which there was this secret collusion between the government, educational systems, and the church, capital C. Of course, it's not a secret anymore. You know, one day, as I was researching intergenerational trauma and the mental, emotional, physical, and spiritual ramifications, I also stumbled across the story of Tuam, T-U-A-M, in County Galway, Ireland, where there had been a discovery of approximately 800 remains of babies buried in a mass grave. Well, I knew it was time to head over there, and so I made contact with various people, and one woman in particular, Catherine Corliss, and I told her, I said, I want to meet you, and I also want to meet the others down in Cork, and I want you to show me around, because this really struck a nerve in me. And so I spoke with Catherine Corliss. You know, as I said, she is a historian that's known for her work in compiling information concerning the deaths of children at the Bon Secours Mother and Baby Home and Tuam in County Galway. And when I was over there, she invited me in. You know, we sat there at her kitchen table, And she brought out newspaper clippings and just all kinds of information regarding that particular site or in the land and the building itself. And interestingly enough, underground in that building were tunnels that connected cisterns. And that's where they found, the remains of these children, that the building no longer stands, but the ground broke through. And they, like curiosity was like, what's going on down here? With flashlights and everybody else. And they came and like, oh my gosh, what was just uncovered here? Can you believe it? And so it confirmed what everybody knew, but may have been afraid to say. Was it true? It was. And there were also stories of child abuse and burials that emerged from the mother-child home, also in Bessborough, County Cork, and I visited that place first. And so like I said, I contacted the people in Ireland working on, raising awareness and accountability for these places within the historical systems of the government and education and the church. And I shared with them initially, how their stories of the mistreatment of women and the abuse of children and the mass burials ironically paralleled Native American Indians' experiences with the United States and the Canadian boarding schools. And we were both astonished to find that in spite of the striking parallels, neither of us knew about each other's country's atrocities. To our amazement, it was almost as if these global crimes against humanity formed this recurring pattern of humanity that was being played out in other places over and over and over again. Well, as I was down there in County Cork, I met a woman there, Carmel Cantwell, who serves on the Bessborough Mother Baby Home Support Group, her and the team. And interestingly, her brother William, he was born there, but he died, I believe, 3 days after his birth. And I believe this was back in 1960. So she has a personal stake in this. And so, circling back, when I visited Cork, I interviewed several women who were born and raised at the Bessborough Mother Child Home. And they showed me, the building, and they pointed to several, second story windows, and they said, that's where my mother was. That's where I was born. And I also heard women's stories of punishment, mistreatment, abuse, which appeared to be a daily occurrence in these state-run religious institutions. And again, this isn't bad enough. There's also been reports of collaboration with the townsfolk around these Magdalene laundries or these mother-child homes. And the townsfolk, if a young girl would run away, let's just say, the townsfolk would return them to the home because they wore apparently a uniform or, their outfit identified them as, okay, you escaped or you ran away from the home, so we're going to take you back. And apparently, there was this underlying belief that these girls who became pregnant out of wedlock were sent to these facilities to work off their sins. Something has to be done. We have to punish them because, they're pregnant, they're not married. And some of the women I interviewed also reported the surrounding communities, again, supported these institutions because they also wanted to rid society and the church of the, as they put it, the mad, the sad, and the bad girls. And so there were different institutions to take care of whether you were gone mad as a girl, or you were very sad and depressed, or you were just a bad girl. Question: who comes up with these labels? Who is that person that started all this? Well, okay, you're depressed, so you're just a sad girl, but we know where to put you. It's like these girls, these women were institutionalized, had no say in it. In fact, many families said, yes, please do it. And as a result, the children that were born to the unwed mothers were considered illegitimate. And since their children were born to illegitimate mothers, neither of them were allowed to be baptized by the church, capital C. I mean, not to mention, these young mothers were further alienated from their communities, as they were forbidden to be churched. And I don't know if you're familiar with that term, but back in the day, that was something that mothers, look forward to, on being churched, on being welcomed back into the church family because I had to stay away and take care of my children. Well, these young mothers who bore their children out of wedlock, no, we can't do that. They were forever excommunicated. And so this, they're forbidden to be churched. It was a term meaning the blessing given to new mothers after recovery from childbirth in order to receive the sacraments again. Okay, and this was through the Catholic Church. And if all of this wasn't enough to add insult to devastating injury already, since the children, considered born out of wedlock, were considered illegitimate by the church, they could be easily assimilated, into the adoption or foster care system. Most of the time it was an adoption without their mother's consent, which also provided a nice income for the church, capital C. And again, folks, I'm not making this stuff up. You can read countless eyewitness accounts of these institutions. Well, when I got over there, something, just unique happened to me. I just can't explain it any other way. But as I walked these grounds with the people, I sensed an oppressive burden that hung over these souls. They hung over them like this huge spider's web. And I've never forgotten that image. And I know that there's very positive aspects to spiders and a spider web. But in this context, it was a different story. Because in nature, spiders are able to spin both sticky and non-sticky silk threads. And so I saw this clearly. So by doing so, spiders avoid getting caught in their own web, all the while their prey is trapped. Isn't that interesting? So ironically, this image accurately describes how individuals feel trapped by a government, religious, educational system. Now, once caught in this web of assumptions and prejudices and penalties, the more these women struggled, the more entangled they become. Well, I went back the following day. Actually, it was morning. And I went back a little bit further than what we had done, the day before. And I passed a small memorial garden behind the mother-child home. And there were stones there that marked some of the babies buried there, as well as some markers for the nuns who were also buried there. And to the sides of this garden appeared to be other places off in the distance where the ground had been disturbed. And it was like little mounds, okay? But these mounds extended greatly. And it was reported that these unmarked graves of children, that's where they are. Well, if you know me, I've talked about how I cleared the land and the traumatic energy that's there and free the souls and so forth. And I often do this in a very Native American style. So after I hung my traditional tobacco and sage prayer ties in the trees, I don't know if they're still there, but I didn't take them with me. I let them stay up. I sat down and I began to play my Native American Indian flute, just very quietly. And I play the Native American flute more as just a quiet meditation. I say I play the flute, but really I pray the flute. And that's what you hear at the beginning of this show and halfway through and during the break and at the end. That's all me playing. Well, this time, as I was playing, I allowed the sound of the flute to pray for the healing and release of the just that negative, hostile energy of the children and the mothers, and whose souls were trapped in this spider web. And I also prayed for the release of the adult community who still suffer the effects of being adopted and unable to connect with their real families. However, what came to me as I was playing my flute or praying my flute, very interestingly, this was the first time that I have started to see a strong connection between not only those who were victims and the pain that they carried in their intergenerational trauma, but I also saw this trauma in the people who ran such institutions. Therefore, I also prayed for those who, out of their own trauma, were guilty of inflicting such pain and suffering and contempt on others. Now, why in the world would I do that when there's so much hatred surrounding what had happened to these young mothers and their children? Well, follow me on this, people, okay? And I'm on a roll here, so please bear with me. I'm going to keep talking right through the break. Perhaps the church and the state officials had been struggling with their own intergenerational trauma and were unable to offer the depth of God's love that they had never experienced. I mean, how are you going to show love if all you know is bitterness and hatred and contempt? You know, and perhaps instead of dealing compassionately with these young girls who were in trouble, let's just say, these religious orders justified their methods as punishment for sins of infidelity. Of course, as was told to me by the members in the Cork community, those that I sat down with, not all these girls who were sent to these mother-child homes and these Magdalene laundries, not all these girls were pregnant by their boyfriends. You know what I'm saying? Some were pregnant as a result of being raped by men within their own families, as well as those who were raped by other men in authority. Okay, you know what I'm saying? Okay? And perhaps those who ran such institutions had been raised to believe that God was or God is a very punishing God, and that their own lives mirrored this oppressive and strict and fearful relationship. If one was not careful to remain pure, God would strike one dead. And therefore, perhaps they wounded others out of their own wounds, which had been passed down through generations and then were reinforced by a system that encouraged control over them and control over others. I mean, who really knows for certain? But one thing is sure. Failure to excavate the land to verify whether there are bodily remains of children there is another way of forgetting what happened there. Okay? Failure to excavate the land on the Bessborough mother-child home grounds to verify whether there are, you know, the remaining 900 and some odd kids. Failure to do this, whether or not the children are there, is just another way of trying to forget what happened there. But it's too late. People will never forget. And in all honesty, when people choose to turn away or forget or deny or just flat out gaslight, it causes this second death in victims and survivors who are crying out to be healed. So regardless, without accountability, restorative justice has no chance to provide healing on both sides. Restorative justice's main point is that how can we heal from the past and how do we keep this thing from happening over and over and over again? Well, another aspect of intergenerational trauma that seems to go hand in hand with the soul's inability, I should say, to move on is the public apology. I am sure you have heard these public apologies from governmental leaders or educational leaders or ecclesiastical leaders. And within recent decades, There's been a steady stream of public apologies made on behalf of the government and ecclesiastical leaders for the inhumane treatment, the sexual abuses, and the prejudiced behavior, and the outright slaughter of people from many cultural backgrounds. I mean, Google intergenerational trauma, Google inhumane treatment of cultures, and you're going to get a long list, not just here in America, not just there in Ireland, all over the world. What is it about this? Why do we treat one another with such contempt and hatred to dismiss people as less than human beings? Like, they don't matter. They're not going to be missed. We'll do away with them and we'll do away with the problem. Well, not so fast, because the dead do talk. And I'm not talking about conducting a séance here, folks. I'm talking about the truth has never stayed buried. Truth finds a way to come to the surface, so to speak. And that's what's happening. These public apologies are just no longer taken as something that can be trusted. Okay? And that's just my opinion. All right? So the public acknowledgement of such behavior, often results from uncovering crimes against humanity. It's like there's no forthcoming of a public apology until they have to, because, well, the truth has come out. And so, it is a result of uncovering crimes against humanity or investigative reporting and or the work of truth commissions and among other means. Okay, but investigative reporting and the work of truth commissions and other studies, they have to be transparent as well. Now, albeit a step in the right direction, some of these public apologies for the historical atrocities often include this air of dismissive justification of, well, that's just the way it was back then. That's definitely in there, in this explanation for mistreatment of people for the greater good of a nation or the world. In a sense, contemporary leaders often offer apologies for the past without accepting responsibility for anything wrong, let alone acknowledging their role in the socioeconomic, the political, the educational, and the religious systems that still perpetuate oppressive schemes. Whether it was the advancement of science, or let's take a look at Manifest Destiny, or, believed to be a divine right, violence in one form or another has always been justified against the weaker, undereducated, undercivilized, and the underdeveloped people. Ironically, this rationale for force always seems to come from the perspectives of people who want to use their military might or political power or religious zeal or just an outright lust to hang on to their power and control for as long as possible. In fact, history often bears witness to this phenomenon from generation to generation to generation. And repeatedly, physical, emotional, psychological, and spiritual abuses incriminate those who have exploited and manipulated their power for either worldwide colonization or a genocide in countries such as America, Canada, the Congo, Germany, Russia, Rwanda, Ireland, Australia, and in fact, anywhere else where violence and genocide have occurred. Now, on one hand, the public apologies do acknowledge the cruel and inhumane acts done to vulnerable populations, okay? And such apologies foster a sense of community awareness, and they want to garner empathy regarding the devastating intergenerational traumatic effects of others' suffering. And as words of empathy are offered, many victims, okay, not all, but many victims and survivors feel vindicated. And they are grateful for the public voices raised on behalf of those who have yet to find their healing voice. It's like they can take just a deep, deep breath And just finally, somebody is acknowledging this stuff. However, on the other hand, some public apologies are very superficial and often are rejected by contemporary populations, by contemporary communities, whose ancestors have not only been victimized in such horrors, but succeeding generations continue to feel that accountability and justice has never really been served. Because for many, apologies, explanation, and offers of financial compensation only add insult to intergenerational wounds, leaving those who live in the contemporary world to continuously feel the sting of a hand that is being slapped across their face. So I just want to recap here, folks, before I go on further. These articles that I mentioned earlier, the BBC report, as well as the Irish Examiner. Again, these articles are important because next Wednesday, March 18th, there will be an organized protest to stop the development of, the Bessborough site. And again, it's at 5:30 p.m. at the Dáil in Dublin, Ireland. If you can make it, great. If you can't, send your prayers. You can reach out to, Cork City Council. You can reach out to the Bessborough Mother Child Home Support Group. And I'm sure that if you Google Mrs. Carmel Contwell, you'll be able to find some contact information there. Okay. So again, I just want to reiterate, why is this so important to mention? Because I firmly believe that no matter when and where humanity's atrocities occur, intergenerational trauma disrupts the identity of the self. So look at it this way. Trauma has this potential to disconnect us from our awareness of who we are as souls. Okay, and how does this happen? Well, the reason for this is that trauma places a distorted template over our perceptions. I mean, trauma says to us, well, that's all there is. That's all there is to you. This is as good as it gets. What are you going to do? I mean, and these are all lies and distortions that come from other wounded people who have yet to embrace themselves as souls. In fact, once we embrace ourselves as souls, once we get a firm grasp of that, we may be astonished by the power of our souls to not only transcend trauma and transform our wounded energy, but also empower others to do the same. Help them find their voice. Empower them. Believe in what they can do. Believe that, just don't give up until you find yourself free from all of this. Work through that pain. And still, as history teaches us, many people have feared the resilience and the power of the soul, and therefore they've tried to silence its trauma. Now, through killings and murders and genocide and starvation and forced assimilation, humiliation, degradation, looking at people as savages or primitive and backward, unworthy, unlovable, and therefore disposable, as those in control see fit, But again, history shows us that many people have feared the resiliency and the power of the soul. And it's like, well, we don't like that, and you're getting too powerful, so we're going to silence you. Sorry. How are you going to silence the soul? How are you going to silence its cry? How are you going to silence truth? Because those things find a way. You talk about resiliency. It finds a way. Maybe within the same generation, maybe a generation or two afterwards, truth always finds a way. But you know what's heartbreaking to me is that these atrocities have often been committed in the name of God, committed by people who should see themselves as a soul. In fact, even when killing is done in, let's say, the name of advancing the kingdom of God, the only thing that's truly advanced is this distorted view from those who will do anything to hang on to their power. And moreover, trauma is not the only thing that's been passed down through the generations, this traumatic energy, but also the very systems that fuel prejudices and feelings of contempt and a distorted view of life that have been galvanized or reinforced, which often leaves generations voiceless and in despair. However, a huge part of healing intergenerational trauma and moving people toward a healthy sense of self involves not only understanding these historical distortions, but also grieving that which has been taken from them. It is a loss. It is a painful loss. And people need time to grieve, even in the midst of coming to terms with their strength and their voice and the resiliency of their soul. Now, interestingly enough, again, if you've been following me for some time, you know I also do counseling therapy. I'm a clinical trauma therapist. And in the process of counseling therapy, I like to share with people who are working through their trauma, I like to share with them the movie, The Wizard of Oz. You know, and they've probably said, oh, yeah, I've seen that lots of times. And it's like, okay, have you ever considered this? You know, this storyline, which we know full well, you know, it offers this powerful lesson because most people can relate to this movie on a personal level. And perhaps one reason this movie is such a beloved classic is that you've got two stories going on at the same time. You know, you see, on one hand, we're taking this journey with the companions of Dorothy, the Scarecrow, the Cowardly Lion, the Tin Man, little Toto, and Dorothy herself. You know, and interestingly, you know, we're off to see the wizard, and they are all in search of something they believe is lacking in them. So their adventures take them to seek the wizard. You know the story. A Tin Man needed a heart. The Scarecrow needed a brain. The Cowardly Lion needed courage. And of course, the only thing Dorothy wanted to do is just, I want to go home. And yet this trip is really about an inward journey that they take to discover who they are. So as they set out, their journey is filled with dangerous encounters and harrowing escapes from the Wicked Witch of the West and her little creepy, you know, flying monkey minions. So after, excuse me, after the witch was defeated, you know, as the wizard commanded, and all was well, the four companions went back to the wizard to receive their rewards. Yet, don't look behind the curtain, okay? And little Toto's like, oh, hey, what's this? Look out, surprise. And the wizard then takes them back in time after the jig was up, let's just say, and takes them back in time. And I apologize if I offended somebody by that term. No offense whatsoever. There's no intention of that. But the wizard takes them back in time and explains that through their ordeal, each of them showed what they lacked. Okay, the wizard just says, Tin Man, come here. You displayed a tremendous heart of devotion and loyalty. Scarecrow, didn't you really turn out to be the brains of the outfit? And Lion, didn't you show remarkable courage in the face of overwhelming odds? And as we all know, Dorothy could have went home anytime she wanted. And she really finally realized that there was no place more magical, let's just say, than her own home and with the people who loved her. In the story of the Wizard of Oz, we have this classic example of people who are in search of things that they believe they lack, but later come to realize they already had those characteristics. Well, I have yet to meet anybody who begins this journey of self-discovery. And everybody has to deal with this. Who am I? Why am I here? What's my purpose? So on and so forth. So anyone who begins this journey of self-discovery, sooner or later must work through personal and family traumatic experiences, as well as they need to re-examine the stories that have been handed down to them by those who, are also in need to come to terms with their own trauma. And you've heard me talk about this, like, how do people tell their story? Perhaps it's the same way, with the same pause, the same hesitation, with the same inflection, the same emotions, and so forth. And if you're ever going to tell your family stories, you better do it correctly. But does correctly mean that you have to tell it from a place of woundedness in you? I mean, we know the history. And as we tell our stories, we have to leave room for, and this is what happened, but, and we retell those stories from that healthier, healed place in us. Sometimes trauma becomes a way in which individuals and families and generations have defined themselves, which internally perpetuates the cycle of intergenerational trauma. Now, if you've ever heard of the term affect regulation, it's a skill, definitely a skill that develops in us, quite early on as we gauge how others mirror their emotions appropriately or inappropriately. I mean, we're very good at this. And although as newborns, we're unable to form words, we were able to form mental and emotional perceptions from how we are being held and spoken to. In fact, we're so skilled at this, at a very, very young age, that we could tell when our caregivers were holding us versus when we were being held by a stranger. Something was different. I mean, we pick up on facial expressions, eyebrows that are raised and a smile indicating love and acceptance, or a furrowed brow and a frown. We interpret that expression as something being wrong. Well, there was a study done back in 1975. It is called the Still Face Experiment, and the developmental psychologist, Edward Tronick, he concluded that an infant develops reciprocal patterns of expression when interacting with his or her mother or his or her caregiver. And when the mother engages her infant with smiles and laughter and other positive facial expressions, the infant will mimic these cues. However, when the mother's face is expressionless and unresponsive, the infant immediately notices the change. And as a result, the infant repeatedly attempts to restore the interaction to its previous reciprocated pattern. So it's like, I don't know what to do. I can't read the expression. There is something wrong. Hello. And tries to get the mother's attention. Smile again. So all in all, Tronick's study supported the idea that at this early stage, our senses are so attuned to reading others and the world around us that our self-identity begins to take shape, and it also continues throughout our lives. Just imagine the potential to foster a healthy sense of self in children when caregivers nurture from the soul. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, this ties back directly to what's going on or what has happened in these mother-children homes and the Magdalene laundries. It's time. It's time to heal. It's time to acknowledge. It's time to make amends. It's time to come to terms with all of this. Well, just want to share with you one last thing. When I finished my research on the Magdalene laundries and the mother-child homes in Bessborough, in County Cork, I decided to end my trip in Ireland by climbing Croagh-Patrick in County Mayo. It's considered one of the holiest mountains in Ireland. Now, it's said that in 441 AD, St. Patrick fasted 40 days on this mountain. And during the fast, it's said, depending on the story you follow, that a group of black demonic birds attacked him. And he rang a bell to send them to the hollow of the demons, okay? And St. Patrick dispersed the birds. Now, others say he was attacked by demon serpents whom, as he rang the bell, he drove these serpents out. Well, as I was climbing this rocky path, I hung more prayer ties on the trees and the shrubs, and I offered gratitude for God for not only hearing the cries of these souls, but also for healing of those who have been waiting to be fully reconnected. Early that morning, it had rained, and there was a slight mist in the air, and so I was unable to reach the top because, you know, the moisture made the shale rocks very slippery. That's all Kirkpatrick is, shale. And yet, as I was coming down from the mountain, I met an elderly couple on their way up who, they looked like experienced climbers. Not bad for old people, okay? And we chatted for a minute. You know, I told them where I was from, and they told me where they were from. And, you know, but in our conversation, which lasted 5 minutes or so, all of a sudden, the gentleman who was there, he said, "Wow, would you look at that?" And he pointed at me to look over my shoulder. I turned around and I saw the most beautiful rainbow coming off the mountain and going down into the Atlantic Ocean. And in that moment, I felt an overwhelming sense of bliss and peace washing over me. And I took that to mean as if God reminded me that generations will no longer suffer in silence because this oppressive spider web, well, they are being dismantled and transformed into beautiful rainbows. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you have been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Again, I am so grateful that you spent this hour with me. And if you'd like more information about this protest, which is next Wednesday, March 18th at 5:30 p.m. at the Dáil in Dublin, Ireland, to stop these developers from building on the site of the Bessborough Mother-Baby Homes in County Cork, Ireland, please contact Mrs. Carmel Contwell, who serves on the Bessborough Mother-Baby Home Support Group. And you can Google either one to get their contact information. You can contact members of the support group and get further details. So until next time, everybody, please be safe, behave yourselves, and be well. Take care.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander on over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Friday at noon Pacific time on PBS Radio TV.